Hey there, CNFers. What is going on? You fired up? Guess who this is?
If you're going to be a writer, you know, you got to work, you got to sweat, you got to write.
If you guessed James Carl Nelson, you are correct. He is the author of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918 to 1919. I love it, baby. Oh! All right, okay, here we are. We, here at HQ, are the creative nonfiction podcast, The Show, where I talk to badass writers, filmmakers, and producers about the art and craft of telling true stories. It's here we learn how they became the artists they are, the struggles they deal with, and the routines that allow them to get the work done. So you can apply those tools of mastery to your own work. Add to cart, man. Well, that's it. It's that simple. Well, a little housekeeping, of course. I mean, you know the drill by now. Go and subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And share this across your platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever. That's really more valuable than anything, you handing it off to somebody else. Be sure to tag the show on Twitter at CNFpod, and I'll happily give you a fist bump or some head-banging devil horns. You can leave a review on iTunes. I'm not going to scoff at that. If you like, and even email the show, creativenonfictionpodcast@gmail.com, and let me know what you liked. Now let's read a fan email. This is what happens sometimes if you send an email. Okay, nobody emailed this week. The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Goucher College's Master of Fine Arts and Creative Nonfiction. Hey, I went there. The Goucher MFA is a two-year limited residency program. Students enjoy summer and winter residencies and intense workshops where you hone your craft with accomplished mentors who have Pulitzer Prizes and best-selling books to their names. The program boasts a great student and alumni network, and its students and faculty have published 140 books and counting. You'll get opportunities to meet literary agents and learn the ins and outs of the publishing industry. Visit goucher.edu/MFA for more information. Take your writing to the next level and go from hopeful to published in Goucher's MFA program for creative nonfiction. I did it. I went there. Great stuff. So, yes, James Carl Nelson is here. And he's made his bones with 4 books now on World War I. World War I, of course, is now starting to come out of World War II's shadow. All war is horrific, but World War I was particularly heinous. Its greatest failure was that it was supposed to be the war to end all wars. Nope, that didn't happen. Certainly did not. James is also the author of I Will Hold, the story of USMC legend Clifton B. Cates from Bellawood to victory in the Great War, 5 Lieutenants, the heartbreaking story of 5 Harvard men who led America to victory in World War I, and The Remains of Company D, a story of the Great War. He received the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's Colonel Joseph Alexander. I want to say Alexandra because of the Saratoga book, and I'm just so conditioned to say Alexandra. Colonel Joseph Alexander Award for Biography in 2017, and is a former staff writer for the Miami Herald. He's a Chicago Bears fan. One more thing. Be sure to stay tuned to the end of the show, where I have an exciting offer to make. I'm not kidding. There is an offer. It's a raffle of sorts, but you're going to have to listen. You're going to have to listen through the entire show. All right. I'm a bit tired of talking right now. So it's time for James Carl Nelson, baby. Episode 140. Woo! Did you have, like, a lot of people who become writers a penchant for the written word and just love stories growing up?
Yeah, you know, it was, I tell people, it's the only thing I've really been able to do fairly well. So yeah. I'm terrible at math. Outside of the natural sciences, I'm just lost. So it was something I could always do. When I was 7 years old, I was ripping off these how and why books about the Revolutionary War the Civil War. And I was writing and illustrating these books. I still have them. It's pretty funny. So to be where I am now, it's kind of like, you know, show me the boy at seven, you know what I mean? So.
And what do you, I know your grandfather was a World War I veteran as well. Mm-hmm. And that really pulled you into writing about military stuff in a very detailed and wonderful way. But I wonder, was history always something you were gravitating towards as a young person?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested, and especially in military history. I grew up in the 60s, and by the time I was 18, it was like, you know, the Vietnam War was winding down, and I was a hippie by then, and I was against war and stuff. So the chances that I was actually going to go were not going to work out. But when I was seven, I was making plans to go to West Point. So things change in between there. But I've always had a strong history, interest in history, and my grandfather's story just grew stronger and stronger inside of me. He died in 1993, and in the intervening 10 years after that, I just got very, very curious about exactly what had happened to him, because he had been shot when he was 26 and lived to be 101, and had a very sketchy story about it. I see so many people now trying to figure out what their great uncle did, their grandfather, it's become kind of a genre, you know? So I was glad I could kind of jump in and sort of, in some ways, get in on the ground floor on those stories.
And as you were developing as a writer, you know, saying that this is kind of the one thing you had a talent for, maybe in high school and even college, what was it about maybe getting into journalism or any form of writing that appealed to you in that way? And maybe who were you reading at the time too that kind of influenced you in as you took on this craft?
Yeah, you know, in high school, I had a thing for the Beats, Kerouac, Hemingway, a lot, Faulkner especially. I took a short story class, and it was reading, but one of the assignments was you had to write a short story. And I wrote a short story kind of modeled after Faulkner's The Bear, as it turned out, which I never even read, but my instructor pointed it out. And there's like 25 kids in the class, and he hands them back, blah, blah. Of course, I got an A. And he goes, of all the people in the class, he goes, you should read Nelson's story sometime. It's pretty good. And I was just like, wow, this is really great. I just love that, you know. So, but then I kind of got lost in between there. I was thinking journalism, but then everybody was going to journalism school because of Watergate and Woodward and Bernstein. So for a while there, I was lost. I worked for my dad as a painter, as a paper hanger. I knocked around, and then finally came back. I went one year to school, University of Maine at Fort Kent. And it wasn't until I was 24 that I decided, hey, journalism. just kind of like, why wasn't I thinking about this? Because I went back to school when I was 23. And from that time on, then my goal became to write for the Minnesota Daily, the University of Minnesota newspaper. And I got on there. I became an editor. And then I got hired right out of school at the Miami Herald, went to the Key West Bureau for a year. So it was kind of once I figured out what to do, it was kind of a natural progression. And so I've been writing for 35 years now. And I always wanted to write a book. I was like, do I have a book in me? Could I write a book? And turns out I have four so far. So yeah, kind of cute, you know.
And since you worked at the Miami Herald in the 80s there and beyond, do you know Mike Capuzzo by any chance?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know Mike.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
Oh, is he? Okay, I've got his book right here. We're Facebook friends. Yeah. He had been in the Keys Bureau before me, maybe a year or two before. So we actually met down there. He came back down he had been moved to Palm Beach, but he came back down. In fact, I interviewed Mike, you know, his book Close to Shore, in 2001, it was like a bestseller. And, I think he just optioned that for a movie finally. I was first trying to get my first book published. I was like, can you read this and, you know, give me a blurb. And, he's like, well, I'm really busy with my own stuff. But, he's an elegant writer. He's a great writer.
Yeah. And, how about Madeline Blaze? Did you overlap with her at all?
I didn't. I know she's a great writer. I used to read her stuff. I mean, I interacted a little bit with Dave Barry, Edna Buchanan, Carl Hyacin. it was a real golden era for the Miami Herald, early 80s, early mid 80s.
Yeah.
Some great people there that Fred Hyatt, I think, is amazing talent they had.
And what did being in such a in a great era for newspapers and being at a great paper that valued good reporting and great storytelling, how did you develop there and develop and improve as a writer from once you got on that beat?
Well, I think, I think that the secret to becoming a writer is to write, write, then write some more. And I mean, I think I do have, because of my background, I think my writing is sometimes kind of journalistic, kind of newspaper type writing, more as opposed to, I don't know, maybe somebody who's got, comes from a different slant, more classical, writing. But yeah, I always tell people, I'm just a storyteller, I don't consider myself anything more than that. But so I think, really, once you've been writing, it occurred to me, I wrote a knockoff little book for my company back, I think in the early 2000s. And, it was about Tom Cruise or somebody. And then I wrote a book about some medical kind of things. And I said, you know what? I could write a book, because I just did. It was not like a bestseller or anything, but it's kind of like, you start from A, go to B and then Z, and you're done with your book. And I said, wow, I could write a book. And that's where I really started formulating my first book, The Remains of Company D, thinking, can I research and tell my grandfather's story of his unit? And it took about 6 years of researching and writing before I actually sat down and wrote it, and then I wrote it again, and then I wanted to get an agent, and I got lucky, and I got Jim Hornfisher, who was the premier agent for military nonfiction and general nonfiction. So I think it's just a process, and I knew that. I always knew that. If you're going to be a writer, you got to work, you got to sweat, you got to write. Mm-hmm. And I think my newspaper career engendered that, because I had to write every day. And I think you just get better and better,
Yeah, there's a great quote that you said that kind of echoes exactly what you just said. And this was when your Company D book came out. You said, my experience as a journalist was invaluable in putting the book together. I've been writing every day for more than 25 years, so the storytelling is just second nature to me. And I had to be persistent and know the right questions to ask while researching the book. I was also able to parlay some hunches into some big scores regarding source material, which is probably a reflection of my journalistic background. So I think that what you said there kind of echoes that very dogmatic way that the very repertorial, like that reporter bulldog mentality, but also a sensibility to ask the right questions and do the research and do the work.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And I mean, I was, I didn't even know where to start. And I just got little clues here and there. Oh, they have records of this stuff at the National Archives. Oh, wow. And so it was a baby step process at first. And I noticed that they had these things called burial files for all the men. And they were at the National Archives. They're now in St. Louis at the National Personnel Records Center. But they're invaluable. People write letters and things like that, and they're all in these files. And I said, that's a great place to start. So I pulled like 125 burial files. And those told more of a story almost than anybody who had survived, as I write in the book. It was like people came home from the war. They didn't talk about it, but people who died, people remembered them. And they wrote about them, whatever. They saved their letters. It was more common. Just little things like that, pulling it from all different places and searching for context. And then having to learn the war. I mean, just having to research, what am I writing about? What's the larger context here? The Battle of Cantini, what really went on there? And I wanted to write the best account of Cantini that I could, but Matt Davenport now has come out with a really good book about it too, just centered right on that. And then Soissons, where my grandfather was shot, I wanted to do a great job on that. So, I mean, I had a ball, I'll be honest. So it's just as a labor of love. Worked out. I was able to get an agent and sell it and get it published. And I was just like, it was a dream come true. I mean, seriously, it's always going to be my baby, that first book.
Mm. And when you first started out as a reporter, what were what would you identify as maybe some of your growing pains as a reporter on that beat? And how did you work through that to become the reporter and the writer that you are?
Well, you know, I was totally, really, when I think about it, I was at the a year and a half at the Minnesota Daily as a student journalist. That's not really much experience. You know, I mean, things move so quickly there. Like I said, within 6 months, I was an editor. This is the turnover.
Yeah.
So when I got to the Miami Herald, I started on an internship in the Keys Bureau, Key West, just me and another person, Patty Shillington. I had a lot to learn. I had to learn, you know, you go down to the cop station and you pull the reports every morning. You go to the court, you do tort checks. You know, I hit interacting with people. You know, I had some episodes where people were really put out by what I'd written or how I'd done something. So that too, like the writing aspect, is just a real learning process. You know, and you mess up. You try not to mess up too much, but you do. Everybody does, and then you learn from that. You know.
Did you have a trusted editor who, even those times when you might mess up or have a misstep, would, you know, metaphorically put his arm around you or her arm around you and just be like, all right, James, like, this is what you did, but let's, you know, keep going though. You've got a knack for it, but let's, you know, just, you know, fix this, but keep going. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah. I had one. His name was John Wolin. And, as when I was, transferred back up to Miami, a suburban bureau up there. And he was like, you're going to be my writer. I mean, he saw something in me.
That's great.
And he would encourage me. So I did have that when I was in the Keys Bureau and I just started right out of school. It's, you know, you're 150 miles from Miami. That's where your editors are. So it was pretty much on your own and it was sink or swim. So, but that was a good experience too, but it was nice to get a little more hands-on once I got to Miami, you know?
Mm. And at what point in, as a journalist and as a reporter down there, did the book bug start to kind of, worm its way into your head as something you wanted to do and exercise, you know, your creativity in that way?
Like I said, when I finally did sit down and just write sort of a knockoff trade little paperback, or a couple of them actually, and yeah. Learned that I could write. And I had always wanted to do something with my grandfather's story. That was what was in the back of my head, of just telling that story and finding out like a detective story, what happened and who were these, you know. And I started researching that a little bit, and I rode away to the 1st Division Museum in Wheaton, Illinois, and they sent me this muster roll after a month. And there were all these names on him, on this muster roll that surrounded his. And I was like, wow, he never talked about any of these guys at all. I wonder who these guys were. So that's where I said, okay, you know what? I think there might be a book in this. And sure enough, there was. The first phone call I made to one of the descendants of a guy who had disappeared. I said, you know, you ever heard of a guy named Roland Leivick? And the guy goes, you mean Uncle Raleigh? So I was like, and they had a whole box full of stuff. I said, you know, it was a slow process of getting the book together, the research, but I just said, that was a sign that this could be a book. So, yeah.
And
that was in like 2003. I really earnestly started researching it. Yeah.
And you've covered so many sort of titanic events of the last 25 years or so, too. Oklahoma City bombing, you know, Columbine shooting, yeah. Unabomber, yeah. So many things like that. And they're such big stories and big events. So how did you, over time, develop the muscle to be able to cover that stuff? Those are so big, and it's overwhelming to think about it. But how did you approach that, and how did you come out of that a better reporter and writer?
Well, you know what? You just have to. I had an early reporting instructor at the U of M who said, you know what? If you're going to be shy, you can't be a journalist or a reporter. It's just not going to work. And I always remember that. Just sort of like I'm not naturally super outgoing. I am more now than I used to be. Sometimes it's hard for me to just approach strangers and talk to them, you know, but that's what you have to do. So that was a hurdle that maybe some people never get over. And so ergo, they don't become journalists or even book authors, because I talked to a lot of people for my first book, interviewed quite a few people just looking to see, can I get something here, you know? And I just, you know, I had Paul Herbert, who was the director of the First Division Foundation. You know, he said, you know, you cold call people. I said, well, yeah, that's what reporters do. And he said, you know, some historians wouldn't do that. you know, they'd approach through a letter or something like that. But it's just second nature to me now. You know, I need some information. I'm going to pick up the phone, find a person, call them, or doorstep them. So you just got to get kind of, you know, you got to be tough, got to be a little bit tough. But at the same time, be a human being, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. That is a learned thing. And it's uncomfortable, I think, for a lot of people to do that, especially cold calling. There's any other ways to maybe make a soft open, but sometimes you just have to, you know, suck it up, dial the phone number and muddle your way through the pitch of who you are and try to sell them on who you are in 5 seconds before they hang up the phone on you. So you might have a chance at talking to them.
Well, that's it. And you gotta be able to accept rejection. You know, you're going to get the phone slammed on you. That happened during, even in my first book, I was trying to get some information about this one guy. And, I called his daughter-in-law on, and she's like, well, that's private stuff. He had letters, but no, you can't have it. I was kind of like, ugh. So I went back to her like 6 months later, and I said, hey, going in saying, hey, do you have any photos of so-and-so? And she goes, oh, I talked to you 6 months ago. Slam. You know, I'm trying to write a book about highlight your heroic, you know, father-in-law or whatever. So, yeah, but I think the journalism was a great training ground for writing nonfiction. Yeah,
exactly. And when you start taking on the titanic projects, that is doing historical recreation, historical narrative nonfiction, what does the nature of your research look like? And how do you start to organize the sheer volume of stuff that you start to accumulate?
Well, you know, I was lucky. My second book was Five Lieutenants, which kind of sprang out of my first book. It's about these five Harvard boys who served in the first division. And I was lucky in that almost all of them had papers somewhere. You know, Richard Newhall had papers at Williams College, and there's a guy who had papers at Harvard. And I contacted a great nephew of George Haydock, who had his diary. And letters. So instantly, once I've located these papers, it was a matter of getting them, you know. And then, you know, that was kind of huge, because there's five different men, you know, different experiences. But at least I had a starting point. The same thing with my third book, I Will Hold, which is about Clifton Cates, who became a Marine commandant in 1949. He had papers at Quantico at the Marine Museum there. And so, yeah, I went to Quantico and pulled what I could, what I thought was important, and then just sort of supplemented through other means. So, yeah, and then this most forthcoming book, The Polar Bear Expedition, there's a repository in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, which is part of it is devoted to the polar bears, and they have a wonderful stockpile of diaries, memoirs, all sorts of things. So that you can keep things succinct, you know where to go. And then you can just, you know, I mean, I use newspapers.com. I use the web, ancestry.com. I talk to people, whatever I got to do to try to flesh out the story. But, and I also, you know, a story like the polar bears, I want to know who's going to be the strong characters in here. Who are we going to, you know, build this book around that I can introduce and follow them through their experience. So it's always an important element too.
And give us a sense of what that's like when you go to Michigan, you find this repository of information, and you're swimming in that information, and it's, you know, and you're going to start panning for gold, and you see it around you. Like, what is that like for you to just be swimming in all that information?
Well, you know, I think I have a pretty good eye for what's important, and what's good, what's not so good, what, you know, what doesn't really have anything to do with this. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about when I was writing Remains of Company D, and I said, you know, I'd have people send me things or I'd find something, and I'd say, oh, I know where that can go. And he was like, wow, amazing. It's like, but you know, I know once you know the story, then you know where you can plug that in. I found this letter, a guy from this Sergeant Willard Storms at Soissons, where my grandfather had been. He also got shot in the abdomen. And he had this great account of this charge on this village of Berzy-le-Sec. And God, I just said right there, okay, that's it. That's it. He gave me the title for that chapter and everything. But I just knew it as soon as I read it. I said, it was like bingo, you know? Mm. So.
And have you had the experience of, I'll just relay kind of how I know how Laura Hillenbrand came across Louis Zamperini. She was researching Seabiscuit, and then on the other side of the article or on a separate page, it was like, you know, the only person who's as fast as Seabiscuit is Louis Zamperini. And she just kind of tucked that away in her files. And of course, eventually that turns into what becomes Unbroken. And,
right.
And I wonder, have you had any of those kind of experiences where you're researching on the one thing and then you see something else, you're like, oh, I'm going to just put that in my back pocket for now.
Yeah, there's been a couple of those. Like I said, Five Lieutenants grew out of – I was looking for context for that first book, It Remains of Company D, for the battles. And so I used a lot of different people because that can't just be about, you know, Company D. They didn't fight in a vacuum, you know. And so I said, oh, you know, these guys – and I found the story of this great friendship between George Haydock and Richard Newhall. And I said, God, this is – I mean, they were like almost – lovers, not that they were, but I'm saying they just developed this incredible bond during wartime because, you know, life is so precious. You don't know if you're going to live. And so it just intensifies it. And sure enough, I'm not going to say who died, but one of them did. And I said, can I, you know, their story, but it can't just be these two guys. They also had acquaintances. And so everybody talked about each other and knew each other and said, well, you know, you're going to build a story around five of these guys. Funny thing about my third book, I Will Hold, about the Marine, I had done a proposal, just standalone book on the Battle of Soissons. And my agent, Jim Hornfisher, who's authored four or five books himself, naval history, he read the proposal and he said, how about a book about Clifton Cates, who I'd mentioned in the proposal? It's like, oh, okay, yeah, check, he's got papers, boom. So it can be just kind of kismet like that.
And when you're recording or when you're interviewing people, do you typically use a voice recorder or do you rely solely on notes?
I usually use a recorder. Just really helps for accuracy. I write slower and slower the older I get, it seems. So historically, I've used a recorder, yeah.
Yeah, and I have to too, and I think a lot of people do as well. I can't tell you how many quotes I've lost over the years of various stories of just my handwriting being so bad. I'm like, I know something good happened here, but I can't make anything of these words. It's just...
That's really true. And that was true. I mean, I think I was better at it when I was a working journalist and, you know, I was more used to it. But if I take a break now and I don't really interview anybody for a while, then it's just kind of like, I'm hopeless. I don't know what it is. So I'm like, I can't do it.
Do you choose to transcribe yourself or do you outsource that to an assistant or a service?
I do that. I mean, one thing that's nice about working with a World War I subject matter, which all four of my books has been, is that it's mostly records and letters and things like that, as opposed to interviews. And it's all in the, you know, up to 1923 now. It's all in the public domain. As opposed to having to go out and, you know, do a book about, well, Korea, you know, something like that, where you have to really do a lot of interviews, guys serve there. I've never really had to do that. It is kind of handy though, World War One.
And when you start gathering all this information and you start to see the shape of the story and what that's going to be like, how do you go about structuring it in terms of your outline or cork boards, index cards? Like, how do you approach the ordering of your book once you have the story sort of fleshed out in your head?
Like you said, it's really in my head. I don't outline. I don't do cards. My first book, I just sat down and kind of started writing, and I wrote the intro about my grandfather. And I think I wrote like seven sample chapters and they were kind of all over the place. So it was forming in my head at that point. But then once I hooked up with Jim Hornfisher, he says, you know, gave me some tips before we even submitted a proposal. He said, tell me more about your grandfather. Tell me more about your search for what happened to him. And in the process, I'd come down here at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd start writing, and it was an amazing thing. You've heard people say it was like I was channeling. I don't even know where it came from. And that hasn't been the case so much for my other books, but I think because I was so fanatical about this story, it just, the words just came to me, the intro to the chapter came to me. And I think, you know, more recently I've kind of developed this technique of starting with the action. I've always been a big proponent of jump right into the action. Yeah, you know, I do that most of my books. That I think has a little vignette saying, here's the crux of the matter right here. Not long. And then go back and tell the story. But chapter by chapter, maybe I don't even know if maybe I do it too much. I start farther forward than I left it off in the next chapter. Then I come back. And I think that's just something that's really worked for me structurally wise. And I want to keep people interested. I mean, I want the story to not be boring. I want it to charge ahead. I really do. So that's really one of my thoughts. You know, there's so much competition out there for media and time and entertainment. So I want to not be boring is basically it. And just really keep that story moving, keep people engrossed, keep them turning the pages, you know?
And to that point, that's a note I made and wanted to ask you, of course, especially dealing with people who are long dead. You don't get a chance to actually interview them and get that kind of firsthand color and recollection. So what is the key and the challenge of bringing history to life out of documents?
I think detail. You know, like Cliff Cates from I Will Hold, I had his letters, and he was a college graduate, and he was quite a good writer. So I was able to use. He's a terrible speller, but he's a good, fair enough writer, and so I was able to use that, and either verbatim or put in my own words, keep the narrative going. The same with the five lieutenants. I mean, they're all Harvard graduates, so they were quite eloquent in their letters. So that helped a lot too. But here with the polar bear expedition, it was not quite the same. It was more of paraphrasing, putting in my own words, telling, but citing them with what they were going through. So it does depend on who you're talking to.
And there was of the several passages I decided as I was reading the book, you know, this one struck me as a great example of, you know, you putting us there and bringing out the feeling of desperation and the need for something, just something to hang on to. And it's like you write or you cite that coffee thus far is unheard of, but often thought of. One of my men remarked to me the other day that if he had a cigarette, the latest Detroit Free Press, and 15 minutes quiet, he would gladly serve the remainder of this emergency without compensation or hope of other reward. So.
Yeah, that was a captain at Company B, yeah. And I mean, you know, that's some good detail. It tells, you know, we don't have coffee, we don't have smokes. I mean, what do soldiers want? Coffee, smokes, warm meal, place to sleep. You know what I mean? So that's a good letter. I mean, I would look at that and I would say, I'm just going to quote this entirely. I think I sometimes tend to overquote. I have to go back and kind of put it back in my own words sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I've been guilty of that over the years. I like their voices, you know, I mean, maybe too much, but I like their voices talking about what they're going through. Sort of one of my weaknesses.
Well, I think I understand where you're coming from completely. I think there's a tendency, especially if someone has a really great way of phrasing something, it's like, oh, you want to showcase them. You want to get out of the way yourself and let them shine.
Yeah, it kind of reveals who they are sometimes, you know what I mean? In their own words. You know, even like, you know, not to go to like a Mark Twain kind of vernacular or anything, but sometimes, you know, how they speak says something about who they are, you know?
Yeah. There was another great line too. There was a battle, you know, artillery was raining on the Bolsheviks and, you know, there was, you know, the scene was, you know, laid waste. It was effective to the extent where the sort of allied forces were able to sort of thwart an attack, and then one of the leaders wrote, you know, it was pretty forlorn, but at the very end he was like, mute testimony that at least some of our fire was effective. Mm-hmm. I was like, what a line. I mean, you got to come across these things and wonder, like, whoa, like, these are just really brilliant writers of their time. And, you know, they're just, you know, they're foot soldiers who are going to hopefully go back to the States.
Yeah, I mean, and one thing, especially with World War One, was most of the officers were either professionals of some sort or college graduates, you know?
Yeah.
So they more highly educated than the rank and file, who are mostly farm boys or immigrants. You know, I don't know where you find much, you know. I have thought about with my first book, are there, you know, foreign language newspapers that might have stories about some of these guys, but it was just like kind of hopeless. They were underrepresented simply because, you know, if they're writing letters, they're writing them back to Poland or somewhere, you know, even Germany. So where would they be? If my grandfather had written any letters, which I doubt, who would he have sent them to? I have no idea. Mm. You know, maybe his folks back in Sweden. He was a Swedish immigrant. You do find people who can just really describe what's going on, and it's just great when you do.
And when you're writing something that is that has such great scope, and you have tons of information to draw from, and, you know, and I always like calling it sort of like the dark forest or the sort of muddy middle of a draft. You know, you're a little too far away from the honeymoon period, but you're still far away from the ending. How do you power through that and make sense of where the story's going when you're stuck in the middle and there's still so much work to do and it's easy to get overwhelmed?
Yeah, it is. I tend to think very linearly, mm-hmm. In general. So like with the polar bear expedition, I knew what battles were to come, which were the important ones. I knew, you know, Company A was attacked 250 miles from Archangel. They were attacked on January 19th, 1919. There's 46 men, 1,700 Bolsheviks. I mean, I just knew. I think I wrote about four chapters on that because the battle, the flight, they were besieged. And that really, to me, is like, I knew that was like the center point of the book. And it's all really the height of the action, too, because after that, people are like, we need to get out of here, basically, because this is not working. So that was a good place to aim for as sort of the plateau middle, you know, as a story arc, because I've got Harry Meade, who's one of the officers of Company A, follow him from the beginning, describe who he is, and some of the other guys, too. And then finally Company A gets out of the line, and then you just kind of slowly pick up the stories of Company B, they're going to get out of line. You know, there's still some big battles to fight. And I knew, you know, sometimes I just, you know, like Clifford Phillips, he's a lieutenant with Company H. Sometimes I hit the web or newspapers.com or something. Here's a guy. Can I find anything out about him? You know, he's been dead for 100 years. But if you can flesh him out through your research, then you can make him a character, you know? And so I'm always thinking I need to, you know, introduce Cliff Phillips. And then we'll get away from him, but then we're going to come back to him because, you know, his story, I think, is emblematic of what was going on over there.
And when you're in the throes of a writing project of this nature, what is the kind of ritual you set for yourself every day? Morning routine, so you kind of warm up that engine and you can hit the ground running and get the work done you want for that day.
Yeah, I've always found that I'm much better in the morning. Mm-hmm. So, I had left my job in October of 17. I had until like April 1st to do this book. So I had to write a book in like less than 6 months. Mm. But yeah, it was pretty much a matter of I get up, I have my coffee, and I'm down in my basement, my little office by, you know, 9 a.m. or so. And, you know, I'll give it, you know, 5-6 hours a day. Because sometimes I'm researching as I'm writing too. Mm-hmm. So it's not just all pure writing. But yeah, I think you have to keep a pretty good routine. Since my second book, I had a routine where I said, I'm not going to do anything on Sunday. You know, just one day a week, I'm just going to clear my head of this, which I think helps a lot. Because then things occur to you. You know, you might wake up in the morning and say, wait a minute, you know, I need to put this in there or something. Something will occur to you that will make you go back in and add something or change something. But I've always been a fast writer. And I think, you know, the journalism part helps that too. You're working on deadlines every day. So I think that's, I'm not a big tedious go back and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, you know, but I don't want to be like Jack Kerouac. That's not writing, that's typing. You know what I mean? So I like to keep a nice pace and sometimes where the story's going, like in any writing, comes to you as you're doing it. You know, you see your next jumping off point as you're finishing, say, what chapter, you know, that's so, always nice.
Yeah, for sure. And on those Sundays, what do you typically do to occupy yourself to unplug from the project?
Well, I play hockey in the morning.
Cool.
And if it's summer, I'll watch the Cubs on MLB TV. And if it's the fall, I'll watch the Bears because I'm from Chicago. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of a homebody, but just relax, do the paper, do the Sunday crossword, chill. I don't really read a lot. I find when I'm working on a book, I don't want to be influenced by anybody else because I tend to read only nonfiction. So I just want to, you know, stay away from looking like I've sounded like anybody else. I'm just kind of a boring guy. Just hang out.
Yeah.
Wow. Walk the dog.
Yeah. And what are some maybe like 3 to 5 books that you do tend to find yourself maybe rereading, or books that you kind of model your style after, or structurally, or in terms of prose, you know, what are some of those that you revisit?
You know, I do go back to books. I like, I've read Nathaniel Philbrick's Mayflower several times. I think he's a great writer, a great storyteller. I'm just looking at my bookcase here now. Some Stephen Ambrose, you know, Band of Brothers. I had Band of Brothers in my head when I was working on The Remains of Company D as a natural takeoff from that.
Yeah.
I have a book here that I don't want you to laugh, but it's called Garcia. It's an oral history of, it's about Jerry Garcia.
Okay.
And I'm just interested in that kind of stuff. So that's, you know, just to get totally away from the war thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just a real wide variety of nonfiction. Battles or else personalities. There's a book I like, Daniel J. Boorstin, former librarian of Congress. He's got a book called The Discoverers, and I'll just delve into that once in a while, sitting in front of the tube or something. And he's like, it's like the discoverers of everything since day one in world history. So it's very interesting. Mm. It's just things like that. You got to get away from war once in a while.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And supposedly, of course, World War I is supposed to be this war to end all wars. And it wasn't. But after the armistice, this Russian invasion is still ongoing. Take us to that moment of, maybe for you, for that moment of surprise that this was still ongoing in that torturous land at such a horrible time of year after the war was technically over.
Yeah, I think the key scene, the key day for me, whatever, the key surprise was Armistice Day itself, November 11th, 1918. They're signing the armistice at the Compiègne Forest in France. And meanwhile, Company B is being besieged by hundreds of Bolshevik warriors. And for them, the war is not over. And I think that's the centerpiece, because after that, they held on, by the way, I'm not going to spoil and tell her the whole book. But after that, it just became like among the soldiers was a little bit like, why are we still here? Because word got back to them that the armistice had been signed. The war was over. So it became something of an issue for the Allied force. All sorts of the soldiers had been sent there from France, English, American, Poles, Italians even. It's become sort of a story of just hanging on, endurance. And I mean, that's why we subtitled it, you know, the heroes of the forgotten invasion. It's just like you can argue that they fought under worse conditions than anybody on the Western Front, simply because of the weather, the overwhelming numbers. They didn't have enough artillery. Their weapons were bad. That's why they are heroes, and they endured and persevered, although 235 of them were killed or died of disease.
Yeah, and the fact that of how ill-equipped they were too. I'm just thinking specifically of their footwear. You know, so these guys would eschew the Shackleton boots because they were too slippery, and when walking, maybe one or two pairs of wool socks up there. It's just like, whoa.
Yeah, I think Hugh MacPhail, when Company A was on its running retreat in the face of all those Bolsheviks, I think he said he put eight pairs of woolen socks on because the what happened was. Ernest Shackleton, famous Antarctic explorer, had developed this boot called the Shackleton boot. But the problem was it had like a – it was like a muckluck, but it had a sort of a slick bottom for the sole. And so they found in those conditions it was just too slippery. Guys were just flailing all over the place. So, yeah, like you said, a lot of them would just put on several pairs of socks, but a lot of them got frostbite too. So it was became quite an issue.
Mm.
But they did have – they had – they had decent equipment. They had decent clothing, per se, for the time, I think. You know, lots of wool, fur jackets, fur hoods, mittens. So and at least in that vein, they were okay equipped, let's say.
And in your research, how did you find that these men, over the course of nearly a year after the armistice, you know, several months into the 1919 before the forces were sort of pulled back finally. What were some moments in there that you saw these men finally had some glimmer of hope or just some way to enjoy themselves a little bit, given how bleak the mission was and the landscape?
Well, I think the thing is there was a vignette of Company A in its quarters. It came from this book, The Romance of Company A. And I wanted to have that in there just to show a little bit what life was like. You know, they're smoking their pipes in their bunks and they're razzing each other. It was thought to be too boring that I was slowing down the action a little bit. So I actually wrote it out. But otherwise, you know, I think the overriding story is, you know, who do soldiers fight for? They fight for each other, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, the key element. And, you know, it was like ongoing. When are we going to get out of here? And finally, you're right. In the spring, it really the pulling out really began in late spring. And then by July, they were all on their way back to the U.S. But it was it was tough for them. I'll tell you what.
And why do you think nobody certainly I didn't know about this ongoing conflict on Russian soil and turf? And, you know, I'm someone who loves history and loves, you know, learning about a lot of these militaristic slants on history. And I had never known about this. So how surprised, I mean, you're in this, but how surprised were you that so few of us in the West really know that this even occurred?
Well, you know, even I was sort of aware more of there was also two regiments were sent to Siberia, to Vladivostok. I was a little more aware of that end than I was of the Archangel end in Northern Russia. So I was there with you. I mean, you run across references and stuff. In fact, this book came from Peter Hubbard, my editor at HarperCollins. He found a WorldWar1.com story about the Siberian end, and he sent the link to my agent, Jim Hornfisher. And Jim sent it to me and said, Peter's like, do you think there's a book on this? And Jim sent it to me, and I said, let me take a look. And I actually started researching both ends. And I just thought the better, more cohesive story was in the Archangel end of the two expeditions to Russia. But I started... You know, I started putting together a proposal, and that's really the first time I ever really knew about this either. I started from square one, and I had no idea. And you know, these proposals run 50 pages or so, and so in the course of researching it, you write it, you get to know it a little bit. But like I was in the dark, like most people.
Yeah, and it's so much of it is it's lost on us, but not for the Russians too. Like they have a long memory of this, and you cite that towards the end of the book too. And so because it's kind of easy for us to be kind of myopic about it, that
that
we just take for granted. Oh, they must not remember either. But no, no, no. They like what was it, Khrushchev?
Right.
Pronouncing his name right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He remembers and cited that in a speech. You know, whenever that might have been, late 60s or late.
I think it was I was in the 50s.
50s. Yeah.
And I think that was when Khrushchev came to this country, and they probably had the famous kitchen debate with Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very famous episode. But yeah, I mean, I talked to some people while I was trying to put that section together, because what does it really mean? Does it mean anything to what's going on between the U.S. and Russia now? The consensus is, you know, that yes, you know, Russia has been invaded over and over by different forces through its history, you know. And certainly the Russian mind remembers the Allied invasions of World War I more than we know in America. Because when these guys got home, they just basically said, okay, that's it. This didn't happen. You know, I'm going to sweep this under the rug. It was like, let's not talk about this anymore. Because it was a mistake. Or it should have been done in real force, that they were actually going to achieve something as opposed to sending one regiment. So, yes, the consensus was, you know, between, Russian meddling in the elections and the invasion of 1918, yeah, maybe not so much, except, you know, maybe it's like, you know, turnabout's fair play to the Russian mind. You know, you meddled in our internal affairs. What's wrong with us meddling in yours? I don't know. I don't know how valid that would be. It's hard to find a real concrete opinion about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, when we think of World War I and the Russian side of it, and I know for me, like when the Russian Revolution happened in, you know, December of 1917, like to me it was like, oh, then Russia's done and they're just doing their thing, you know, trying the communist revolution and Lenin and Trotsky, and everyone's kind of washed their hands of them. And then you didn't even, I just can't believe it. I hope a lot of people get that out of this book, that there was just so much more going on in the East that, that occupied a lot of the forces from Europe and beyond.
Oh yeah. And I mean, you know, the Brits who ran the Northern Expedition, they had big plans. They were really, some of their generals were really talking about, we're going to incite, when we land at Archangel, we're going to incite a general counter-revolution against the Bolsheviks, and we're taking it all the way to Moscow. And in fact, you know, as a whole, the farthest anybody got was Company A, 250 miles from Archangel, you know, so quite short of 600 miles to Moscow, or 1,000. But yeah, it is an interesting episode in history that is not taught here that I know of.
Yeah. And are you finding now that World War I is starting to come out of, in terms of the coverage and the writing, starting to come out of World War II's shadow a bit?
Yeah, I do. You know, when I started researching the remains of Company D 15, 16 years ago, and I was trying to find an agent and this and that, or even just a publisher, you know, that would just publish it without an agent. And they're like, well, no, we're, you know, books about the army in World War I don't sell. Okay. But, you know, I'm not going to say that since my book, but since then, there have been plenty of books that have been published to great acclaim. You know, Patrick K. O'Donnell's recent book, The Unknowns, I mean, I think he's doing fabulous with it. I think there's, what happened was, you know, the centennial arrived last year, which helped stoke interest. And like I say, I think, you know, you get to a certain age, you know, I was in my late 40s when I started wondering what had happened to my grandfather. And I think you get a little older, you get more knowledgeable about the world, and you start to think more about your ancestors and what they went through. And I think that with the baby boomers has happened. They all of a sudden, they don't know a thing. And why is that? And they were trying to research. And I think that's fueled some of the interest in books about World War I. I think they're much more prolific and they sell much better, I think, than, you know, 15 years ago. And I did, and the Remains of Company did quite well. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wrote, you said in an interview about with Men from Company D, but it might as well apply to Polar Expedition too. You know, you said that I hope people come away with a new appreciation for the young Americans who fought and died in World War I. And a new appreciation for the lasting effects the war had on the survivors. And I hope they come away realizing that while these men fought some 90-odd years ago, now 100 roughly, they were really just like the soldiers who are fighting our wars today.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And that's one thing I do try to do in these books is write about unknown, you know, ordinary Joes, citizen soldiers, unsung heroes, whatever you want to call them. And trying out, you know, like the question was, when I was staring at that muster roll before I really plunged into Company D, was, you know, who were these people and what became of them? And and it is universal. I mean, we think people are so different because they lived 100 years ago. They're not. People are people, I think, really, you know. They all have their same, you know, hates, loves, desires, aspirations, whatever. But they've gone unrecognized. And, yeah, I can't recognize all 4 million who served in World War I, but, you know, just, you know, I can hopefully represent the experience, like with the polar bears, what they went through. Those are just the same as Company D, same guys, you know, farmers, factory workers, whatever, you know, who got, you know, caught up in these extraordinary conditions.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing bout of storytelling, and just when you try to put yourself in their boots and realize what they were dealing with, and also just the vast history of people trying to invade Russia, whether it's Napoleon and then Hitler, it never works.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mentioned in there, you're always up against General Winter, you know.
Yeah,
Napoleon found that out. Hitler found that out. And, you know, the polar bears found that out, you know, that the polar bears, the allies, they thought once winter fell, and we're talking temperatures of 60 below, 70 below, they thought the fighting would stop once winter arrived. Everybody would just hunker down in the snow, try to stay warm. That's when the war really began, you know, like in November. And that's when, you know, meanwhile, the Bolsheviks under Leon Trotsky were recruiting and growing a large Red Army and making plans to drive these guys into the White Sea. And that's what began, like I said, in earnest in January of 1919.
Well, James, this book is it's an incredible bout of storytelling about something that has just gone unnoticed to so many of us, even people that even proclaim to know a little bit about history. So I want to just thank you for the work you've done on the book and the other books you've written, which I'm eager to dive into. And thanks for the work and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your interest.
Of course. And where can people find you, find more about your work online if they're not already familiar with it?
You can go to my James Carl Nelson Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, go to my Amazon.com page. They've got 3 of the 4 books up now. I think they wait until the publication. Like, publication of the Polar Bear Expedition is February 19th. So
great.
After that, all 4 books should be on there. I'm trying to think. I used to have a website, but I don't anymore because I decided Facebook was a lot cheaper. I don't know. Google me. See what comes up.
As always, that was a pleasure. Big thanks to James for the time and the insights. Be sure to kick over to Facebook and like his page and see what he's up to. Let's keep our conversation going on Twitter. Tag me and the show, at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod, and let me know what you liked. All right? Why not? And here's that offer. Promise you, if you made it this far, here's the reward. I have a beautiful hardcover copy of James's book, The Polar Bear Expedition, the one you just heard so much about that I want to raffle out. So how do you enter this raffle? There's the rub. How are you going to enter? You must share the show on Twitter. There must be a minimum of 10 tweets this week for the book, to win this book. Once 10 or more of you have shared the show and tag it at CNFPod so I see it, I will pick among those names, reach out to you, and send you the book. Fewer than 10, no go. 9, I'm sorry, not going to happen. 10 or more, got to be at least 10. The contest ends March 1st, 2019. Listen, share, win, maybe? Hey, head over to BrendanOmara.com too, hey, for show notes to this show and the previous 139. And subscribe to that monthly newsletter. growing list. It's a fun list. I share my book recommendations and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast and maybe some other cool things that I read over the course of a month. You don't want to miss out, man. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. All right, man. That's got to be it. Have a CNF and great week. And remember, if you can't do interview, see ya.